your book Against the Crowd. Can you explain to us a little bit about your background, please?
Yeah, I was the oldest son of a civil servant, brought up in middle class security and comfort in suburban North London. And I got basically interested in betting, really, as quite a young lad. I was always keen on maths at school. Stats were my big thing. My favourite part of Christmas was sitting down with my dad and my uncles and playing pontoon on the dining table after Christmas dinner, even if it was only for pennies. I actually stumbled across horse racing more or less by chance. I was playing in a under 15 cricket match, a district match, and the game was played at Alexandra Palace Cricket Club, which was the ground was in the middle of the loop of the old Ali Pali racecourse. I was fielding on the boundary one Monday evening, and this bunch of horses suddenly galloped past, and then about 90 seconds later they went past again. I thought it looked a lot more exciting than fielding at third man in a cricket match. So the following week, from my parents' newspaper, I established there was another race meeting at Ali Pali. I cycled there after school, paid my way into the Silver Ring, still wearing my school uniform and cap. I must have looked a complete tool, basically. But the first time I ever went, I got the tote treble up. 5 shillings stake, 17 and sixpence returned. Wasn't very difficult because it was a 5-4 favourite, a 10-1 on favourite, and a 4-5 favourite. I certainly wasn't into picking outsiders in those days. And it just blossomed from there. I got a Saturday job in the local betting shop, Bruce's, which is still there. And I started to go racing whenever I could. After a brief interlude of 2 years of marriage, when obviously all that had to stop, I became a single man again in the early 70s, and horse racing became my number one hobby. I wasn't really into the sport, I was just into the gambling side of it. I found a job in Swindon with a financial services company, was on a good salary, got a company car, and that made it just so much easier to go racing all the time. It grew and grew from there. Once the on-course tax was taken off in 1987, I started pushing my stakes and, you know, was betting hundreds on horses. I got made redundant at the end of 1991, which might have had something to do with the fact I took so much time off to go racing. And at that age, 44, no wife, no kids, redundancy payment covered most of my mortgage that was outstanding. I thought, give it a try. It had always been a lifelong ambition to try and be a full-time punter. If it hadn't worked, I'd have gone back to work somewhere. But 15 months later, I landed a 39,000 win in the jackpot at Lingfield the day after the Cheltenham Festival. And from that day onwards, I was rolling. And I've never looked back, really.
Alan, several of the successful punters of these days that I've spoken to have cited your book Against the Crowd as a massive influence on them. You're obviously successful in 1995 when you wrote it backing against the crowd. So why did you decide to share your knowledge with them?
Well, the book stemmed from getting to know Ian Carnaby, who I'd first seen working with SIS and doing the programmes that were shown on the old British Sky broadcasting before Sky merged. I met him one day at Salisbury, we got talking, and I told him that I'd got some ideas and themes written down. He agreed to have a look at those and see if it could be made into a book. To be honest, at the time, it never occurred to me that, you know, I was giving away any great secrets. And I don't think when you read the book, there are great secrets in there. What I was trying to get across was that for every individual, there's has his own way of punting. But what you need to do is to sit and think about what you're doing, to actually have some sort of plan, not just to go at it bullying a china shop, which I'm afraid I think so many punters do. For me, there are two crucial skill sets you have to be a successful punter. The first is the obvious one, that you have to be able to analyse form, read races, spot horses that are going to win in future, and so on and so forth. But I think the much more crucial one is that you have to be a good gambler. And I think a lot of that is down to instinct and the rest is down to psychology, if you don't mind using that word. And I think that's the skill I've got in spades. I just seem to have an instinctive know-how for when to step in and have a really big bet, when to step aside and not get involved. And it stood me in really good stead over the years. I think there are lots of people who can read races, analyse races, come up with long price winners, probably better than I can. But very few of those people have got the gambling skills, what might be called the balls, I suppose, to actually step in and do the betting. You'd have seen this, I'm sure, yourself in your association with bookmakers. The man who is perfectly happy to have £100 on a 6-4 shot, but if he fancies all at 20-1, he has £5 each way. And for me, it should be the other way round. And it's finding those long price winners and lumping on them that makes the difference between making a profit and making a living. That's for me. That's the key. The book I didn't think was anything special. I just enjoy writing. I actually don't think Against the Crowd is a particularly good book when compared with the second one, which I think is much better written, because I'd had the experience of doing the first one. But it did seem to catch people's attention at the time. Whether I was saying something new, whether I was saying it in a different voice, I really don't know. I don't think I had done much more than follow on from what Nick Mordyn had already done, basically.
So you talk about the psychology of gambling, and you also mention the book's Terrible Losing Runs, which I think anybody that bets suffers from. How do you cope psychologically with them?
Essentially a belief in my method and my approach that it will come right in the end. I use reinforcement, if you like. I've still got hundreds of hours of videotape of races in which I've backed the winner. I've got scrapbooks that show results of races where I've backed the winner. I've got diaries of every single bet I've placed going back to the beginning of 1983. And they're still in my bookcase, those diaries. It's all there to show me that in the past it's all worked and it's gone right. You just have to keep plugging away. If I can quote an example, there was 2004. I happened to be looking at this the other day because I was writing a piece for a blog. The first 6 months of that year, I lost 11,500 and nothing had gone right, basically. And then I backed a winner that was a horse I'd been watching from the previous October called Alcarcid, who I thought had changed hands surprisingly cheaply at the Newmarket sales at the end of 2003. And he won the old Newton Cup, and he won it really comfortably. And I picked up 8,000 on him. And there was a sudden infusion of confidence. The next two Saturdays were winning, and we came to the Goodwood week. And in the first 4 days of that Goodwood meeting, I had 12 bets, 8 of them won at prices from 9-4 up to 10-1. And it was just a complete turnaround. But all I'd done was to keep going on in the same way as I had been operating during the losing run. Belief that it would come right in the end.
Going back to your book, Alan, and I do admit it was written in 1995 when computers weren't quite what they are now. Even though you had the background and the knowledge, you were resisting at the time using them in your armoury against the bookmakers. I assume that's changed now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that changed when things started developing with off-course and offshore betting at the end of the 90s, where you could suddenly bet tax-free off-course if you were using the internet to bet with the firms who were located in Gibraltar. And of course, soon after that, along came Betfair. I mean, I joined Betfair, I think, in December 2001. Would that be right? Or would it be 2002? I can't honestly remember which year they started up, but I was there pretty soon after they started. And yes, I mean, inevitably, you cannot now avoid using a computer. For the last 15 years or so, up until quite recently, I've sat in front of a computer most days. And when I've been betting, I've been obviously using the computer to do so. I've had very little on-course betting until about 3 months ago. I finally decided I'd got sick of death of sitting at home all the time and decided to rejoin the world of betting on-course, which I've been doing now for about 3 months.
So with the computers, do you also embrace these super powerful form books, etc., in the computer? Do you still use the old school?
Absolutely not. No, basically, I use the the websites that post the at the races, Racing UK, and I don't really do anything. I don't do any form of analysis on there. The only records I keep on there are spreadsheets from my betting, as opposed to writing it all out in a diary. I don't have any notes or anything like that online at all. It's all still done the old-fashioned way with me, I'm afraid.
So obviously the game has changed massively in the last 20, 22 years. I know it's obvious, but how has it changed, and how have you adapted your methods in that time to stay above water?
I think most people miss the biggest change. Obviously, the biggest change is the rise of online betting, the fact that we can now view films of all the past races going back many years, the fact that the racing is visible to everybody who is willing to pay the subscriptions. That all of that makes a huge difference. The amount of information available to punters now is just beyond belief compared to what was available when I started out in the 1960s. The key for me is that the racing programme has also changed so much. I'm not a great fan of betting in big field handicaps, but the BHA and the bookmakers seem to think big field handicaps are what we all want. Lots of each way betting. Well, I don't bet each way. I'm a win only man. So in recent years, I've moved away from handicap betting and concentrated very much on the racing at the top end of the programme. So on the flat, that would be listed and graded races. Over the jumps, it's good novice races and the best races at the weekends. I still like to go racing midweek, but as much as anything, that's scouting rather than betting. Yeah. The only section of that would be going to the flat racing, where you can still find an edge, in my view, from looking at horses in the paddock, but more significantly from watching them go down to the start. Which is something of an art form that it cannot be basically included in the odds. It can only be a subjective thing that each individual watches the horses and makes his own choices from them. But it's been reasonably profitable for me in recent years. But it's only possible at certain courses now because so many of the clerks of the course allow the runners to go straight to the post. You know? My favourite being Salisbury, where because of the makeup of the course, every horse has to go past in front of the stands before the start.
Now, one thing that did surprise me when I read it was that you said at the time, sorry to keep harking back to the book, I know it's here and now, but most of my research came from there, that all weather was the future. Now, has the future panned out as you expected in the respect of all weather racing?
It hasn't quite, but it's not that far off, in my opinion. I'm firmly of the belief that if the originators, if the Muddles, for example, had made the interesting decision to dye their surface green, the antis about all weather that still exist simply wouldn't have had such a case. It's because it looks wrong to us in this country. If you can imagine that in the last century, say 100 years ago, racing on dirt or an artificial surface had been the norm, and then suddenly at the end of the 1980s somebody had suggested racing on grass, you can absolutely guarantee there would be people who would be, this grass racing is rubbish, I don't want to get involved with it, it's all bent, and so on and so forth. Yes, there is definitely corruption within all-weather racing. Nobody can question that. The facts are there on the table. But is that because it's on the all-weather, or is it because it's low-grade stuff? It's a bit of a debatable argument for me. The better all-weather stuff, the maidens in the autumn, the good quality races that are now cropping up, those are really worthwhile races. You can now look to go out and buy a horse specifically to run on the all weather, and know that there will be and are good races for you to run in. Races worth, you know, £15,000 to £20,000, and of course you've got this all weather championship now at the end of the season, which offers massive rewards. So I do think all weather racing. And all-weather racing is a terrible term to use. Artificial surface would be better. Basically, it's just flat racing, but it's flat racing with something different under the horse's hooves than what people were used to. Yeah.
Okay, so I've got a little bit of an issue with the all-weather, the all-surface, whatever you want to call it, racing. I do feel, even though I don't have figures to back it up, that the amount of times I've backed a horse and I feel like I've had my pocket picked is a lot more frequent than it is on normal racing of the jumps, i.e., you've struggled to get on at 5-2, it's gone off at 5-1, jockeys miss the break, stuff like that. Do you think it is more prevalent because it's all weather, and do you think that it should be, you know, sort of stamped down on more, because it seems to be ignored, to my point?
There's no logical reason why it should be more prevalent on the all weather, other than that maybe it's because, as I say, it's the smaller stables, the jobbing jockeys. I just don't know the answer to that, Simon. And I recognise that your view is shared by an awful lot of people. I mean, I very rarely bet on the all-weather racing these days. The speed figure systems that I wrote about in my books back in the 90s, they don't work on polytrack anyway, so that's become a non-starter. But I'm perfectly happy to bet on an all-weather race that has the level of quality that I like to bet on the turf. In other words, if there's a group race or a listed race on the all-weather, I don't have any problem betting on those. Yeah. One thing positive you must consider about all-weather is that it's fantastic for the horses. They love it. They don't come back shin sore. They don't come back stiff. They don't come back with muscle injuries or foot injuries. I've owned horses, and we've run a lot of them on the all-weather. I mean, I had one, my best horse, who won 9 times Salute. He had problems with his joints. It would have been completely impossible to keep him going on turf. But we were able to run him up until the age of 10 years and still win him races. He won a race at Wolverhampton as a 10-year-old, and that just wouldn't have been possible without the all-weather surfaces. The horses really relish it. And that, I think, is reflected in the fact that every trainer in the country now is prepared to run his horses on the all-weather as part of their build-up, you know, in 2-year-old mains and 3-year-old mains.
You were a known face, and the ring used to buzz up a bit when you walked into it, and then you've gone on the missing list for like 2 decades, or it seems that way, and you've alluded to the fact you've been sat in the darkened room in front of that damn computer. Can you tell us what your tactics have been on the exchanges?
Back when they started, I immediately saw it, you know, the huge opportunity from being a layer, and for the first probably 7 or 8 years from 2002 onwards, I was in there every day, laying race after race, occasional back, but mostly lay, reasonably high stakes, major amount of turnover, small profit margin. And I was perfectly happy with that. And I was still out going racing occasionally. I would still have big single win bets at the festivals at Cheltenham, Ascot, Goodwood, that sort of thing. But the day-to-day was all about being a layer on Betfair. I lost the enthusiasm for that at around about the 2010, 2011. There were family issues. My mother was ill, and I was needed to look after her quite a lot of the time. And when I came back, I found that I didn't have the concentration. I mean, by that stage, I was 65. I couldn't generate the amount of mental strength needed to sit there all day and do that work. I also realised that if you lower your turnover as a layer on Betfair, your commission, of course, goes up, and the commission then bites away at what is a fairly small profit margin to start with. So I stopped, basically. And from about 2012 onwards, I've been a backer only again, back to where we were in the early 90s, basically.
So here we are in 2017. I bumped into you at Cheltenham, you waving a winning ticket at me, you're back. And we're never here talking to you. So what are you up to these days?
Well, as I say, I'm enjoying going racing again, something I haven't done for a long time. I've been out now about a dozen times in the last couple of months. I'm not every day, and I never will be, but I'm still enjoying it. But a lot of my time now is spent on things other than betting. I've become involved with quite a lot of owners, a couple of trainers, and basically I'm used by them as a sounding board for horses on offer at the sales, placing ideas about placing horses they've already got. And I think the reason I'm popular is firstly because I'm willing to say exactly what I really think, and secondly because I'm not holding the hand out for a commission or a fee for offering the advice, basically. So a typical example would be a trainer, this happened this week, a trainer is at the sales. The trainer sends me an email, says, what do you think of lot such and such? And I have a quick look through, respond back with my view of what sort of races you could expect it to be able to win in this country. And some of that involves being heavily into the French form. The last 5 or 6 years, it's been much easier to access the various French databases and also films of French races. So I've made a point of trying to keep on top of the form over there, which has obviously proved beneficial when the horses have arrived over here. I've been able to back horses first time out in this country, which our utterly incompetent handicappers have completely underrated, guessed at basically, and have got hopelessly wrong. I imagine the most famous one would be Au Petit Soin for Paul Nichols winning the Coral Cup. Go back a few years before that, Sanctuaire winning the Fred Winter. These are just horses that our handicapper got badly wrong from day one based on the French form.
Would you fancy a phone call from a handicapper for giving them advice, or is that too much turning the other way?
I have actually written a paper which was sent to the BHA making suggestions about changes to the handicapping system, particularly that there should be some sort of appeal, that there should be a written set of procedures that owners and trainers can know what the handicapper can and can't do, that there should be considerable variations in the race programme regard to handicaps. So instead of having every handicap the same, just being a rating band and that's it, there should be far more handicaps for horses that haven't won for 6 months, haven't won for a year, have never won a £5,000 prize, so on and so forth. I also suggested some new varieties of handicap race, and also that we should be changing the system. The fact is that in 2017, with email, with text, with the internet, we're still tied to one weekly update to the handicap ratings, which is based on the publication schedule of the printed racing calendar. It's nonsensical. We get horses carrying penalties in races. Everybody knows the horses well in. You know it, I know it, and the other owners know it. And the horse goes off odds on, we get an uncompetitive race, the horse wins again, and it's all because our handicap system is basically archaic compared to what exists abroad. In France, I can tell you, handicap ratings are updated within 2 days of the race and applied, and additionally, no horse is ever raised for not winning a handicap. In other words, you finish second in a handicap beating a shorthead, your rating for your next handicap will be exactly the same.
Well, back in the day, I'm assuming that you got very used to having bets clipped or refused or bluffed, as they used to be in the good old days. And I assume you still get restricted now. Is that the case?
Yes, it certainly is. I think it's an inevitable fact of life. I mean, I had a Tote Credit account for a long, long time, and they were really very good to me. And that got closed after a sequence of all-weather winners in late 1998. I had an account with Hills Online. You can ask the chaps on the rails. That lasted 9 months before that got closed down. Although, to be fair, I did take 28 grand off them in that time. And I know that the chaps who worked on the rails, like John Best, were quite peeved that the account had been closed, because they were just taking my bets and going off and backing them on their own account. And then when the offshoring started, it didn't take very long to get closed down by the likes of Ladbrokes and Victor Chandler. With Ladbrokes, I made the heinous mistake of having 400 quid on a 12-1 winner with the Gym Crack, a horse called Bannister, and that was the end of that one, basically. And it's continued in. I mean, without Betfair, we've all come to a grinding halt early in this century. Now I'm back on the racecourse betting, and I'm finding no problem at all getting on. I mean, it's actually more fun. You know, people are telling me, oh, you're not going to get the best price, you know, it'll be bigger on the machine. Well, yeah, but I'm getting the fresh air, I'm getting the exercise, I'm handling cash again, which I thoroughly enjoy, going back to the old 80s and 90s days. And I'm seeing the horses, you know, and I think I'll get enough of an edge from that to more than compensate.
And how do the fractions react when you ask for a 1,000 to 160, a 6-to-1 shot?
Do you know what? I haven't actually done that since I came back, basically. Mostly because I've been backing horses at under 5-to-1, I think. But I look forward to what's going to happen the first time I try that on. Yeah, yeah.
You get it. Well, a lot of people are watching this wondering how they can be Alan Potts. First of all, of course, they can track down the book. But 2017, what are the golden rules for punters these days?
I don't think they've changed much, Simon. It's have a plan, and particularly a staking plan, which doesn't involve what we mentioned earlier of having big sums of money on the short price favourites and tiny amounts on the 20-1 shots you fancy. Obviously, that you can't do the same for both. There will be limits to what you can get on, but the maximum minimum should be a lot closer together, basically. And if it isn't worth putting your minimum on, don't have a bet at all. Watch a lot of racing. I mean, I basically, the strongest thing for me has been seeing horses, whether that's on television or whether it's in the flesh. It's seeing something. I mean, a lot of this is down to experience and instinct. But it's seeing something that tells me that's a horse that's worth following. I mean, if I can give an example, if you were to dig out the film of Cue Card winning the Holden Gold Cup, which I think was the first race after his novice season, and it was just electric. His jumping, the distance he won by, which I think was 30 lengths. And from that moment onwards, I was an absolute Cue Card convert. Now, it didn't pay off very much in that first season, but when he finally won the Betfair Chase, I had a really big bet, and I think the odds were 9-8 or 9-1. I backed him when he won the Ascot Chase. I backed him when he won the Ryanair. It's just something, from that day onwards, I wanted to be with Cue Card at every opportunity. It was the same when I saw, in fact, the same generation, when I saw Bobsworth run against Cue Card at Newbury. I think he beat him in a 2.5 mile race, and the amount of pace he showed on the running stuck in my mind. I could see it every time Bobsworth ran. He didn't like his next two runs because he went right-handed. And I can remember going to a Cheltenham preview evening, and it was one of the, I can't remember whether it was Grand Cru or Dynast was the favourite that year, but it was one of those pipe French imports was the favourite for the Sunderlands. And all the other pundits on the panel, the jockey, the trainer, the bookmaker, the commentator, they were all in favour of the French horse. I was giving it large on Bobsworth and telling them that back on a left-handed track he was going to be unbeatable, and thankfully that paid off. It's what you see, I think, and how you interpret that is by far and away the most important thing. What's in the form book, everybody gets. What's in the stats and the trends now, everybody gets. But what you see, that's just your opinion, basically.
Getting away from the racing to finish off, Alan. Very interesting little piece in your in the book. The list of pubs near racecourses. And hopefully you've kept them going, and they're still very welcoming hostelries for the race goer.
Most of them, sadly, are closed, I'm afraid. The pub on Cleve Hill in Cheltenham is now a private house. The one near Newmarket is a Thai restaurant. And several of the others are gone. The one near Ascot is boarded up and is subject of a planning dispute between the brewery and the locals. It's all very sad, basically. I don't drink as much as I used to anyway, so it hasn't really affected me. I pretty much gave up on heavy alcohol consumption about 15 years ago, so about the same time I stopped going racing on a regular basis. So.
I did tell a few people that were quite excited that I was interviewing you. One of them is a previous interviewee, Andrew Mount, and he told me that you became his absolute hero when he went to a Cheltenham preview night, and at the very end of it they asked the panel their bet for the week, and you gave one at Hexham or somewhere, and it duly won. Can you remember which one, what that was?
I certainly don't remember the name of the horse, Simon, but yeah, it would have been the 4 mile chase at Hexham that takes place on the same afternoon as the Gold Cup, or used to in those days when Cheltenham was a 3-day meeting. If I couldn't find a decent bet at Cheltenham, what's wrong with having a bet at Hexham? It's something I think I did mention in the book, that a selling hurdle winner at 5-1 at Toaster puts the same amount of money in your back pocket as a 5-1 winner at the Gold Cup.
Well, that's what you call against the crowd. Well, thank you very much, Alan.
My pleasure.
Star Sports are the proud sponsors of the English Greyhound Derby. All part of our commitment to the sport from the home of Greyhound Racing Betting. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.